Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. It's my pleasure to welcome Dave Snowden to the Exagility podcast. I've been following Dave's work now for a number of years, since one of my colleagues showed me one of the original videos that looked like they were done by BBC or something like that, and on YouTube, very popular ones now, including the one on the children's birthday party. It's like an onion, you keep peeling away the layers and you find more and more and more. And I'm really deeply into it now, really looking forward to the interview today, and I hope you get to enjoy it as well. Dave's work became more popular since it was published in the Harvard Business Review, and has just been blossoming since then. It's been used in all types of work, in all sorts of industries, and most recently it's featured in the EU Field Guide on how to deal with complexity in a crisis, and COVID is actually cited as an example. So hope you enjoy this interview with Dave.
Dave, welcome to the Exagility podcast.
Hi, good to be with you.
Thank you. We're here today to review your latest book, Kenevan, Weaving Sensemaking into the Fabric of Our World, publication in 2020. And I really enjoyed, it was probably long overdue, it was great the way you blog post regularly, and your blog posts are really deep as well. I really enjoyed that. It was lovely to see it all kind of packaged in a book as well, or a lot of it. So how was that process for you, Dave? Was it a bit of a surprise to you, or were you involved in the whole way through?
No, I wasn't involved. It was the 21st anniversary of Kenevan in five domain form this year. So that's when we published it.
Yeah.
So I got asked to write basically a pamphlet on the origins of Kenevan, where it came from, because it was a pamphlet that went up to 7,000 words rather than 3,000 word limit, and refused to change it. And then that became one chapter in the book. But the other chapters were all commissioned by the community, so they represent a diverse set of perspectives. I think it should be read as lots of people's experience of and uses of Kenevan. It's not the Kenevan book which describes how to use it. That one is coming out later. I think actually this was a good way around to do it, because people saw the framework from different perspectives and different uses, in that book.
Yeah, indeed. I noticed some stories from the police, from armed forces, the Navy, lots of different organizations, well-being, healthcare. It was really nice to read that.
Yeah, if you have a look on Google Scholar, one of the things I'm proudest of on Kenevan is it's been used by lots of people without our need to engage. One of the famous articles is by somebody in the Cabinet Office on the role of religion in the Bush White House. And I still remember she sent it to me and said, "You must have read Karl Rahner." And she's the only person to have ever spotted the influence of Karl Rahner in my writing. And that just happened. And I think that you've got something right when people can use it without your direct engagement.
Yeah, indeed. I've noticed that on LinkedIn as well, that people are publishing articles about Kenevan that are pretty much on message. And I've noticed you liking some of those as well.
I don't like deliberately. Yeah, it's not too bad. It's when people put the five quadrants of Kenevan or decide to miss out a little bit because they find it inconvenient. I tend to jump on those a bit, but I'm fairly lax about it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's kind of a hobby for you. You're very active on social media. So I think that people fooled you into writing about yourself with this big section in there from you on basically your history, really getting involved in this whole thing. I knew that you were interested in rugby because you've been wearing some rugby jerseys from time to time, and there's no exception. But I didn't know about the poetry and opera. I didn't know about that at all. How long back does that go, that interest in poetry?
Oh, way back. I mean, my mother was fought her way out of a working class community in Cardiff through education to study German. And actually, I think the late 40s, early 50s, she went to study in Hamburg, which was really brave. She had to wear a passport around her neck so she wouldn't get raped by British and American soldiers. She got a love of opera when she was in Germany, which she brought back. And of course, the Welsh are a musical nation anyway. Welsh National Opera was initially an amateur group of choruses which got together. So opera was a part of my life from a very young age. And poetry, anybody who went through a grammar school, which I did, you learned a poem every week. That was part of what you did. And that stayed with me forever. We performed a Shakespeare play every year. So we learned to speak in iambic pentameters. And that sort of education, I think a lot of people are missing out on them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think my daughters, they maybe study one or two plays and that's it. And they don't act the play. They're just learning stuff on rote and stuff like that.
We performed it. I mean, by the time I was 16, I'd done Macbeth and Caesar, Macbeth and Antony. And yeah, I was one of the few boys prepared to do it. So I ended up getting a lot of parts. We did Pygmalion. So I paid the number two on that when I was 10, 11. And learning that play was, I don't think anybody would even think of making 10-year-olds do that. And yeah, but we did it as a full school play, you know, in primary school.
Good stuff. I'm curious what your favourite character was of all of the ones you had to play.
I think actually for the speech, the render, I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him, from Antony, that is just a magnificent use of rhetoric in terms of the way it works. So it was a delight to deliver it, even though Antony is not a particularly nice character. Macbeth, I thoroughly enjoyed. I mean, Macbeth is just this wonderful character who gets caught up into temptation and can't escape it. Yeah. And interestingly, there was a wonderful production at the RSC the other day while we were still going, where the three witches were young girls, 14 or 15, dressed in white. And it worked brilliantly because it just completely changed the way you saw the play. I think you ever have favourite characters. It was, what's the play this year and what are we going to do and where are you going to sit?
I also noticed you got some awards, and I think it was like a big amount of money for the time.
Yeah, that caused endless amusement within the county because it was a memorial for a director of education, Hayden Williams Memorial Prize or something. It was given for extracurriculum contributions, and like they couldn't not give it to me given what I'd done. But if the history of this, my mother and Hayden Williams had been ferocious enemies to the point where actually he threatened to make sure I didn't pass the 11 plus if she didn't give up a political campaign. It got really nasty, and so there was huge amusement within the North Wales Labour Party when I got that award. So yeah, loads of people turned up for the presentation who wouldn't normally. It was like dancing on his grave as far as some of them were concerned, I think. But yeah, it was £60, which in 1970 is a lot of money. And the assumption was you'd do something like buy the Encyclopedia Britannia. And I just got Dad to drive me to a big bookshop in Liverpool and literally filled up his boot with every Penguin classic I could find. And that's where I fell in love with philosophy and history and everything else. So that was my first library. And the books are all around me now and extending into bookshelves all over the house.
Yeah, and you read those books within a year as well, didn't you? And
yeah.
And that started a whole rhythm of you just being well read.
Some books I go back and read in more detail, but reading them in the way most people read, sentence by sentence, that's really difficult for me, like really difficult. That's the way my dyslexia manifests. But it's actually quite useful because you can sense or see patterns and you can get through stuff quickly.
So, Dave, I'm very curious about your time in IBM, because it seems to me from reading the book, that's where a lot of the ideas were born during your time there, and where the initial ideas got developed and then you took it much further later on. Can you tell us a little bit about how you even got into IBM in the first place? What attracted you to IBM?
I was fundamentally upset when it happened. I didn't volunteer. I was conscripted. So IBM bought the company. So I was responsible for strategy by that time. I'd moved out of business management and decision support. And we were about to float the company. We'd been a management buyout from Thorneum. I was one of those who was on the buyout. There were only five of us left by that time. And we were in Perda on the Friday when IBM phoned up, and by Monday we were sold. It was quite scary, the speed with which it happened. The money was, I was going to go and acquire three companies in Europe. I was going to create a universal method center, which I was going to run. And our slogan was one method, many cultures. And that was against IBM. Yeah, which was like many methods, one. All the anti-IBM marketing material was ready to run. And then we were in IBM and we lost our partners. So it wasn't fun. But I was lucky because I created a thing called the Genus program in data sciences, which had been the turnaround that got me into strategy, where I put object orientation together with Rad Jad. I was one of the three founders of DSDM back in those days. We met in a pub in Cheltenham. We didn't go to a ski resort.
Yeah.
And we put those together with object orientation. And that became something like 80% of our sales and turned the company around. So I was seen as a creative in that sort of sense, which I've always been. And IBM therefore decided, like, I get one of those interesting roles by which do whatever you want as long as it's interesting and you accept the right people. In fact, there was one famous year when my boss, who was brilliant, and HR complained that he was retrospectively doing my targets. So we get together at the end of the year, agreed that what I'd done was what I probably should have done, but couldn't have been forecast. And then I get my bonus, and they got pissed off with us. So they demanded he set a target, and he was brilliant. He wrote a target by which I can't remember how much I got, but every time somebody of director level in IBM demanded I was in rank and I was fired, I got X. And if it was a vice president, I get more. And he sent it into HR. And they just went ballistic. And he said, I'm very sorry, I'm authorized to do this. It's measurable, it's achievable, it's linked to the business goals. Here it is. And I earned a lot of money off Ginni Rometty. So IBM was fun in that if you had the right sponsor, and yeah, I worked for Lou Gerstner on leadership development as well, it was okay. I would not want to be in a business management role. And I knew this very clearly, if you're linked with revenue with important clients, nobody can touch you. And I was lucky. I got summoned down when I was working in the Institute for Knowledge Management in Boston. At the end of the knowledge wars in IBM, which were pretty savage. Mm. I learned a lot about corporate politics during the knowledge wars, but we had a peace settlement in Nice. And as a result of the peace settlement, and it was literally a peace settlement, Larry and I effectively directed it. I didn't know that we'd be monitored. And I got this call to go down to Washington to meet the CIA, which was a bit scary, because they'd heard about my work on complexity and narrative, and then found this old guy who I got to like really well before I realized he was John Poindexter. He used to be Reagan's national security advisor, which is a good socialist I'm not meant to like, but he's still a good friend, a brilliant guy. And effectively, we then got heavily involved in a big DARPA program before and after 9/11. And that drove a lot of the material. Kinevin was around by then. But I remember I drew it on a piece of paper in John's desk, and he looked at it and he said, that explains 50 years of failure in American foreign policy.
Mm.
And from that, we really moved on and did it. And that was heavyweight, serious work. I'm in the Pentagon the night before 9/11, working on understanding current situations without political overlay, which was a successful project. Flew out that night, picked up the news, driving up to Warwick University the next day, 2 weeks before I knew my team was still alive. And I got flown back in on an American transport plane from Singapore. And life got really serious for a few years then. And that's when a lot of the development came.
Mm. And you did a lot of work in Singapore as well, because you mentioned you flew to Singapore.
It was again an interesting story. So I was in IBM and Singapore picked up the ideas. I mean, I went out to speak at a conference and somebody heard I was coming and they didn't know who I was. So they sent somebody to look at me and see what the hell I was doing, because I hadn't come through an IBM vehicle. This guy called Jimmy Quang, who was actually really good, and he decided this was something which would differentiate with the government. And without Jimmy, it would never have taken off. And I met Janet Ang, who was the country general manager, who was also really good, did a lot of work with her. And I still remember, she said, I don't understand you the way I don't understand Peter Ho, so I'll arrange an introduction. Peter Ho was then permanent secretary at the Ministry of Defence, which is like most of Singapore's expenditure, so a really important client, went on to be head of the civil service. So we had a 10-minute appointment. 10 minutes became an hour, and then Peter gave me a job as an advisor to the Ministry of Defence. And that made me really popular with IBM, because nobody got that level of contact, because very bright, very intellectual guy. And then Singapore government approached me when life was getting really difficult in IBM, like nasty. My top cover had left. Lou Gerstner had left, replaced with Sam, who was old style IBM. And they basically said, if you leave IBM, we'll give you a contract for our risk assessment and horizon scanning system. And if you stay in IBM, we won't. So I left and became one of the two main designers on the risk assessment system. And that's when we set up Cognitive Edge as a company.
Okay.
So that's like the history. Turns out Singapore monitored DARPA programs, yeah, as well. So there was that contact coming through. And to be quite honest, by that time, we'd been an emergent business unit in IBM, which was a thing I set up to imitate the famous Florida case, and decided I fancied doing it. So I took one of them. We were the only one to hit our targets and the only one closed, because we didn't, when they took our money away, we were meant to go and beg for it back. I just got money from the US government instead, and that was considered unforgivable. So it got difficult. I still remember finding a forged email trying to get me dismissed when I was in Australia after that. And I realized there was no point in staying. It was getting nasty. So yeah. I hit 50. They offered early retirement. Singapore made the offer. It just all made sense. And we set up the company in Singapore.
So Dave, I'm now going to refer to Sonia Blichnow's chapter was Organizing Principles, the Spirit of Canevin. And Sonia, she seems to be based in South Africa. She was says here that she looks after the commercial business of Cognitive Edge, is also founder and managing director of More Beyond in South Africa. And what really struck me here were there were three principles. And I was wondering if we could just step through each of them just for a few minutes. And I didn't know about these principles, so I was really delighted to discover these. And the first one was we embrace messy coherence.
Yeah, and that one came from way back. So I can't remember when I first coined that phrase. Sonia would have first heard it when she was on one of the IBM training courses in Gold Reef near Joburg. It's basically, it's a very simple thing. Complex systems have multiple levels of entanglement. So Alicia Giraro famously said they're like bramble bushes in a thicket. So the essence of complexity is they're messy, but there is coherence to it. And part of the problem in organizational design is people try and remove the mess too early. It's called premature convergence. So they put too much structure in place too quickly and they miss the richness. If you want another metaphor, it's like wildflower gardens as opposed to formal gardens. So the embrace messy coherence says embrace mess, but it's got to be coherent. And coherence is a key concept in Canevin. It's a classic case. You can say that we know that evolutionary theory is wrong, but it's coherent. So we discover new things, like we now know how culture inherited through epigenetics. Biology wouldn't have accepted that 15 years ago. It now does. So there's a science gets things wrong and it makes changes, but it's always coherent to the facts at the time. Whereas young Earth creationism is just incoherent full stop, so it's not worth exploring. So the concept of coherence is key. If something is coherent, it's a valid journey to take, to explore. So that's the concept of messy coherence. Accept the mess, spot the coherent patterns, follow those through. Don't just accept any mess. So that's roughly what that means.
I'm just thinking like of some facilitators when they run workshops and they get people to put posters up on a wall, or these days on a mirror, whatever kind of technology you're using yourself. And they get very quickly into voting, you know, which ones to zone. And that's kind of bringing them down the funnel. Is that where you're talking about maybe trying to remove the mess too quickly?
Yes, and it's the same as things with Delphi technique, which works the same way. You end up eliminating too many things too early. So you get to the end of the process and you realize you should change your vote. The problem with dot voting is the first people influence how other people vote. So we have a whole body of techniques around complex facilitation, which interestingly I developed in IBM Denmark. Because I wanted people to speak in Danish, which I don't understand, and I would facilitate in English. So we were focused on removing the facilitator footprint from the environment completely. And we've done a lot of work on that. And that includes clustering. We would never do dot. And again, that's the coherence thing. Once something is coherent, you start to run experiments. And this is actually one of the big things in Canevin on conflict resolution. And I've been a C-level executive a lot of my life. You sit at a desk, eight groups of people come in, they've all got a proposal, they're all defects, they're all valid. How the hell do you make a decision? Once you understand complexity, you don't. You test each of the eight ideas for coherence, six pass. You give them some resources, you run the experiments in parallel, you see what happens. And that's the key principle. To agree your idea is coherent is easier than to agree you're right. And it allows us to make progress.
Thank you. The next principle I struggled to understand, maybe you can help. So the principle two, enable descriptive self-awareness and self-discovery.
So enable descriptive self-awareness is mine. So I'll explain that. And Self-discovery is more Sonia. She's coming from psychodynamics type background, which, to be quite honest, I disagree with. The self-discovery thing is Sonia. I wouldn't go with that. I think it links in with the Senge nonsense about personal mastery and all that sort of stuff. So, and we're more concerned with group processes. So what we would do, for example, the project I was describing, we can extract archetypal characters from people's stories. Mm. For example, I might take managers' archetypes and employees' archetypes from the same story base and present both to the managers. And I said, that process we just took you through, this is a Danish example. We didn't influence you, did you? Because we told you what to do, you did it, but we couldn't interfere because it was all in Danish. And you produced these archetypes. Well, I said, that's what we did with your employees, and look how different now. What do you think that means? So descriptive self-awareness is taking, and we do that the same way we do it with sense makers. So we'll present a situation, we'll get everybody in the workforce to interpret that situation into a quantitative framework. Then we'll draw maps, which show common groups and different groups, and say, what does that mean? So what you're doing is you're putting people in a position where they work things out for themselves rather than being told something. And my big problem with systems thinking is that, and with Senge, I'm just writing an article about Senge's fifth discipline, which I've had to reread, is it's very culturally specific about what behaviors are valid. So in contemporary political terms, you call it neo-colonial. It endorses a certain type of culture and a certain type of behavior. And people don't change on that. If you say you need to be more open to your staff, they say, I am bloody well open to my staff. They get defensive. If you say, we took your staff through this process, this is what they produced. We took you through the process, this is what you produced. Look at the difference. Then they have to take it into account. Yeah. And that's descriptive self-awareness.
That sounds similar to something I did in a large UK bank before. The execs had a different view where it wasn't, there was a particular kind of survey that we asked the staff to do. And we asked the execs to come up with their view. There was a difference, and it did drive a discussion.
I remember one company, they had one of the big rooms with a one-way mirror. It's a mirror to people in the group, but you can see through it, all right? It's used for marketing. So I just took advantage. So I got all the executives lined up on the one wall, and I had a microphone. I had a headphones with a microphone in the room. And I brought a bunch of security guards in, and they told me how to place the executives in order based on how important they thought they were. And we took a picture. Then we did the same with secretaries, the same with middle management. And then we showed them the picture, said, that's how the secretaries see you, that's how middle management see you, that's how secure, what do you think it means? And it's the same principle, all right? It's that common process and ask people difficult questions.
And the third principle was attuned to timing and flow. As someone said to me years ago, timing is everything. Is that what you mean there?
Sonia, not me again. I don't think it's wrong. I don't think I'd express it that way. I think there's a thing in complexity called path dependency, which means everything has a past and you can't start from scratch. That was one of the big problems with business process re-engineering, although it drove a whole industry. So fundamentally, what we do on that side of it is to basically recognize that things are changing over time and different contexts have different attitudes and different beliefs. And a huge bunch of Kinevin is about flow, right? And time perception changes with flow. The danger is you get into sort of things like constructor law, which I don't agree with, which basically says everything is like a tree root flow system, yeah? And you get into these very linear framing of that problem. And I think it's quite interesting. I was up on the Lake District the other day walking plateau. Yeah? And there's another one in Wales on Plinlimmon. Three major rivers go from the same half-mile area. Mm. And if you put water in the middle, it's an open question which river it'll end up in. It's not clear. So I think organizations are more like that. Occasionally they flow, occasionally they're static, occasionally they have multiple directions. Again, they're entangled. And so there is time, there is flow, but the flow isn't linear. And I think that's the danger with that particular metaphor. Jen made a major contribution last year, the final unresolved tension in Kinevin, which is why it's more or less stable now. There's one big change coming in a few weeks' time, but not to the shape, was when we resolved disorder into what's called the aporetic, which is a Derrida concept. I'm quite proud of the fact I've got a concept from one of the most obscure continental philosophers into common speak. I'm quite proud of that one. And the concept, Derrida famously says that a question isn't a question if you know the answer, it's a process. So the only valid question is one to which you don't know the answer, which stops you to force and think again. So Jen wrote a really good blog post on that. She actually interacted with me. That's in that article. The water issue is a long-standing metaphor I've used to describe the difference between resilience and robustness. Yeah, I use a seawall, not a dam, but it's the same sort of principle. Yeah. Mm. So if you have a seawall, that's robust. So it, you know, it holds the water out. You can drain the land on the landward side. You can put it to agricultural use. Everything is good until the design conditions are exceeded and the seawall breaks. Then it would be better if it hadn't been there in the first place. Mm. So the character of robust systems is as long as they're robust, they're brilliant, but when they become brittle, they're fatal. Now, the alternative, and there's an interesting example of this in Southwest Wales, where a seawall burst and they decided not to repair it. And a salt marsh formed, buggered up the Round Wales coastal walk because you have to go at low tide to get through it or walk all the way around. Mm. Aside from that inconvenience, it works. And the thing about a salt marsh is that it's constantly changing the way it shapes and works based on what happens to it. It gets inundated. When it gets saturated with water, even when it's saturated, it doesn't release the water in the way that a dam releases it. So that's a metaphor for a resilient system. And by the way, that includes Taleb's concept of anti-fragile, which is systems that succeed by get stronger by failure. We've known about before Taleb came along. And they're normally classed as types of resilience, and one of the more risky types of resilience, by the way. So a resilient system survives with continuity of identity over time. And that's a salt marsh. So that's linked with another concept in complexity, which is called requisite variety or necessary inefficiency. So if your system is over-focused on efficiency, it loses adaptive capacity when things change. So it's why, for example, one of the big things we focus on, this is in the UField guide, which I wrote on complexity management, and Alessandro illustrated and designed. And one of the big things we argued there is, based on a lot of work, is that you need to build informal networks in preparation for a crisis. Because informal networks cross silos in what's called context-free information flows. So I'll give you the illustration. So the Singapore government has dense informal networks, because all of their government officials go through military service together. So they go through annual training, they were in officers' messes, sergeants' messes, they know each other. It's a democratic, meritocratic network of informal contacts, which is really critical to making the civil service work. In contrast, in Britain, the informal networks come from a couple of private schools and a couple of elite universities. So that's an unhealthy type of network. But if you can actually build informal networks, and we have a method called entangled trios, which gets it done in 6 months, then you've created channels through which information can flow in circumstances you can't yet forecast. And in all the interviews I've done post-COVID with executives, what mattered to them was their informal networks, not the formal systems. Because the formal systems assumed a certain type of information flow, it no longer got it, so they failed. Yeah, and that's a salt marsh example. Is you're creating connections without purpose within the system on the basis that will give you resilience, because those connections will come into play when they're needed. And that's a very different attitude from the process, you know, Six Sigma generation.
So if we think of most recently at the time of the recording, another storm that swept through New Orleans, I think the new levees, they did hold up. But it's probably a question of time. There'll be a storm that'll maybe exceed the capacity of those levees.
That's going to get worse. It's a problem in the Thames. There's no way they can build embankments fast enough to stop what's going to happen to London going underwater frequently. Now, again, there are design features for that. I can take you to houses in Gloucester, for example, built on river floodplains, and they have no plaster on the walls of the ground floor, and they have stone flags without concrete in a damproof course. Now, you would think that didn't make, and also they have hooks in the beams. And it turns out it was because the area constantly got flooded. So if it gets flooded, you want the water to drain away quickly. If you've got a damproof course, it doesn't drain away. If you've got flags with cracks, it drains away quite quickly. Mm. If you have stone walls but no plaster, you just scrub it off. You don't have to replaster. And literally the hooks were there, so you could actually hang up your furniture, literally put some ropes onto the hooks and haul the furniture up so the flood water came through, it wasn't damaged. So in a modern design house, you'd have the electricity come in at the top and go down rather than the bottom and go up. So you can design systems which are naturally resilient. And that would be an example of doing that. And in an organization, that's like key.
Key message in that chapter by Zhenko was that essentially you can try to control things. It'll only get you so far. You could end up going into chaos. And often it's better to, as she said, go with the water, really, and just try to manage things as they happen. But try to plant some resilience around the way you're talking about it.
I think resilience is a different way of thinking.
There was also a reference to actionless action as well, which I thought was interesting. Basically, action and inaction, you know, maybe deliberately going into a state of confusion to figure out what to do next and deciding which way maybe you should go, which kind of interventions are appropriate.
Yeah, I think that's what I've been calling the Frozen 2 strategy. So somebody said to me earlier on this year that I should go and watch Frozen 2 because it was a good, the complexity it is, right? So unlike Frozen 1, which I think is less good, Frozen 1, the heat with the heroine is Frozen 2, I think the real heroine is the younger sister, the one without the magic. And there's this point where she's in a well in despair and she starts to sing a beautiful song, Kirsten, whatever, which is do the next right thing. And that's fundamentally what complexity is about. Understand where you are, find out what the next thing you can do, which is going in the right direction, do it. Stop idealistic plans about the future.
So, Dave, another chapter that really intrigued me was by Reva Greenberg and Budivine Birch. They were talking about the use of the Kinevan sensory framework for type 1 diabetes, just trying to figure out what your sugar levels are. Do I need insulin today? When do I need it? What time of the day? And so on. And I think an example was given where a meal was ordered and then the waiter took the order and the order basically self-injected, got the insulin. And then the waiter came back saying, oh, sorry, your meal's going to be 25 minutes because there's a problem in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And that was an example where she was trying to control the situation and she was thinking that this was something that could be controlled and maybe an element of kind of self-failure, a feeling of self-failure, but actually the realization that managing your blood sugars, if you like, it's like managing a complex problem. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I had type 2 and reversed it. And I was lucky because I got the diagnosis when I was walking around the house by email. So I had put it a bit into perspective. And gave me time to think about it before. I knew about the research, which basically said starvation reverses diabetes. I combined it with exercise. But when you're managing something where you can't take anything for granted, so I'll give my own example. If you've eaten a certain amount of calories, you've got to go and walk for 10 miles, otherwise everything's going to go badly wrong. Yeah? That's on type 2, where you can reverse it, and you've got that sense of, this is curative. In type 1, you can't cure it. And you've got to manage complex situations and you've got to do it by injection still. That still hasn't changed. And you've got to constantly monitor things. And part of what we're doing there is to capture that experience because that influences legislation. You could argue, for example, that, it's almost like in restaurants, you could actually have gluten-free. You could have, I'm diabetic, therefore I need X amount of notice. And the restaurant staff are aware of it because they weren't aware of it. So we're trying to get that sort of learning into the system, but also provide peer-to-peer support. So one of the big things that SenseMaker does, which they used on that project, is to allow people to access other stories like theirs. And discovering things through stories of people like you is far more effective than being told them by medical professionals. Again, come back to my own case. So I was triggered. When I got it, I was quite depressed. I was like, is everything over? Then I realized I cure it. And then I wasn't doing as well as I should do. And somebody sent me a BBC 2 documentary about Ray Gravel, who, if you know your rugby, was one of the great Welsh centres, the great period in the 70s with Barry John and all those. He was in the team which beat the All Blacks. He then went on to be a Welsh language commentator. Everybody in Wales loved him. A million people tried to turn up for his funeral. There's only three many people in Wales. He was a diagnosed diabetic. And the video showed him coming home and saying, but I'm only drinking this much wine a week. And I thought, shit, I'm doing the same thing. And it was that sort of intimate story which caused me to, trigger the next stage of behavior. And that's what we see happening. It's stories of other people like you which influence you, not medical profession talking about glucose levels and monitoring. Stories matter.
And looking for patterns as well between the stories, I guess.
Yeah, and we're just releasing a new version of the software, which is codenamed Gemba. And the concept is you capture day-to-day stories of micro things, that you can find other stories like yours from other people within the same system. And again, what that's doing is peer-to-peer flow rather than everything have to be mediated. And that's more the way we gather knowledge. We listen to people's stories. We're less likely to listen to corporate guidance. And then, of course, which stories people take account of is useful metadata.
And there were some interesting case studies, if you like. I'm not sure what the right term is, but there was a chapter there by Lou Hayes Jr. on use of the Kinevan and the police force. And also there was a chapter as well by Trenton and the Navy. And also there was a chapter on armed services, people practicing this, using it to help them to make decision making. I'm curious, how often do you get pulled into serious investigations where there's some massive problem they don't know how to deal with? Have you ever been called in almost like Columbo to help them get their thinking organized?
We more provide things for them to do it without needing. So McChrystal, for example, used Kinevan in Afghanistan in his second book, Kinevan's All Over It, right? So Kinevan is actually used in all of the US military forces. It's in the UK manual. It's in the Swedish manual. And military people have always got it fast because it's a famous case of no plan survives first encounter with the enemy. So the American Marines, if the battlefield plan breaks down, they fall back to heuristics. Yeah. One of the proudest examples I've got is not Lou's police force up in Chicago. It's one in Florida where the SWAT team went into a hostage situation. The SWAT team leader drew Kinevan on the back of a concrete block with a nail and those things and talked to his people, and they agreed it was complex. So they didn't follow SOP, standard operating procedures. They did some experimental probes to see how the hostage taker would react, and people's lives were saved. So I'm quite proud of that one. But critically, when they phoned up headquarters, they said it's complex, we're probing. The same Kinevan framework was used strategically as operationally. So the language of complexity was embedded into the process and nobody challenged what they were doing. So you'll find Trent has a brilliant book on the carrier strategy of the American Navy. And he and I both taught at the War College in Rhode Island. And he used Kinevan in that context to understand how strategy changes in military environments. So it's frequently used in military.
So Dave, another chapter that really struck me, lots of really good chapters in this. We're just taking a selection here, but this one is from Harold Jarsh. And on page 200 of the book, he talked about rethinking accountability. And there were three bullet points that he left there. One of them was, if you've got stable systems, then you're really looking at outcome-based accountability. If you have active self-organizing systems, then maybe you're looking at learning-based accountability. And then for random and chaotic systems, you're maybe talking about sharing-based accountability. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, Dave?
Yeah, again, a slightly different take. I go way back in knowledge management terms. And also in long distance cycling, which we share. It's difficult to have a disagreement with Harold. He always refuses to have a fight. So we're agreed on the ordered system. The thing about an ordered system is you've got a linear relationship with cause and effect. The trouble you got in a complex system is the goals don't work. So for example, I can give you meta studies on all studies on human motivation, which says when people are working for explicit goals, it destroys intrinsic motivation. And where do we most need intrinsic motivation? Health, social services, and education, and where we have the highest number of goals. So the science basically says you shouldn't do that. So it's okay if you don't need intrinsic motivation to have goals, but if you do need it, it doesn't work. Now, some of the work we do, which is linked to what Harold said, is called a vector measure. So vectors measure direction and speed of travel for intensity of effort. So they don't have an outcome, but they provide a quantitative measure of, are we going in the right direction at the right speed without consuming too much energy? And that links with a new theory of change called more like this, fewer like that. So in a complex environment, you measure vectors. In an ordered environment, you measure outcome. In a chaotic system, there ain't anything you can measure anyway. In fact, if you look in the EU field guide, the role of leadership in a crisis is to distribute decision-making and centralize coordination. Because there's no way you can make the decisions in the center. It's just too much going on too quickly. So you have to distribute decision making, but then you have to ensure coordination so that things don't go down bad wormholes. We do that with, for example, trios. If three people from different backgrounds agree on something, they can do it without reference up. So there are mechanisms to make that go faster. The only exception to that is when a crisis initiates, is a leader, then that's the only time they make decisions, and they're pretty draconian. But their objective is to increase the number of options available to people, not to solve the problem. In Canavan, that's called a switch to apparatus. So if you look at what Jacinda did in New Zealand at the start of the COVID outbreak, she broke the law to lock it down. She had no right to do that, but she did it. And that meant New Zealand had far more options than Britain and Sweden and the US, who waited too long. So by the time they got around to doing it, fewer options. So I think some of this is, and that's one of the functions, is to recognize where you are and what you do in that environment, and to build that training and those heuristics into people up front.
Yeah, that makes total sense from a chaotic point of view. Sometimes people interchange the word outcome and learning. Of course, outcome would be you're expecting something to happen, whereas learning is you tried something and you didn't know what happened, but something happened and you're basically learning from it. So I guess from that kind of mix, does that mean that learning-based accountability makes more sense in the complex space?
Yeah, learning-based accountability works in complex space, but it works in small teams with high trust. It doesn't work at an organizational level. So people will admit failure, for example, to people they trust, but they won't admit failure to be shared with other people. If you have an organization which says, yeah, we're a trusting environment, there's no such thing as a bad decision. Yeah, if you make failure, come and tell us about it, you won't be punished. That's a Darwinian technique to eliminate the fatally naive early on in their careers, because they will be. So trust then tends to exist in tighter networks. That's why, for example, we use overlapping trios for decision-making in complex. You know, three people from different backgrounds agree, they make a decision, it doesn't work out, they're not held to blame, because the process is designed to handle uncertainty.
Yeah,
I'm more focused on process, which is independent of individual qualities. And that comes from the military work I've done, because the military assume they will get sub-average people, and by rigid process make them above average in performance. So I've taken it from that sort of context and taken it on. So I think that's important to understand that. And it's interesting, as I said, I've just been rereading Fifth Discipline, which was an inspirational book when it came out in the 1990s. The trouble is, you read it now and it's so dated, it's really good at saying what was wrong. Then it says all these things that people should do differently, and you realize after 30 years, none of them have happened, despite all the PR. Yeah. And you realize actually they're just platitudes. Nobody's going to say they're not doing them. Yeah, you listen to your employees. What manager is going to say, I don't listen to my employees? Well, of course I listen to my employees. And I think our focus from a complexity is stop talking about how individuals should change, because that's too hard and takes too long. Talk about how you change interactions so that people have to change based on the interactions. And that's the complexity principle. In complexity, interactions matter more than things.
Can you give me an example of one of those, Dave?
Well, I'll give you one any parent will recognize. When your children hit puberty, you worry about who their friends are, because you're no longer their prime reference, because they're now interacting with other people. Their whole personality can change if they get into the wrong group of friends. Human beings are profoundly influenced by who or what they're interacting with. So, for example, one of the techniques we use a lot is transgenerational pairs. So we put people who've just joined the company with people who are about to retire. That actually is a brilliant stabilizing influence. Mm. Wouldn't work if you put somebody in a middle management position there, because they're a threat to the person who's retired and they've got too much authority. I called it once grandparent syndrome. You know, grandparents will tell things to grandchildren, they won't tell to their children, and vice versa. So again, what you're starting to do is to build processes based on predefined interactions so that good things are more likely to happen, rather than talking in abstract about what sort of qualities people should exhibit, where you know that they think they do that anyway.
Thank you, Dave. Just coming back again to the book, page 264, there's also a reference here as well to strategy in the complex domain. So there's a reference to Henry Mintzberg's work in terms of intended strategy versus emergent strategy. This is from Steve McCrone and Ian Snape. And they had two diagrams, and essentially you had the level of change and the kind of the vertical axis and elapsed time on the horizontal axis, And they had a kind of a shared vision off in the kind of yonder, but then in between, kind of on the 45-degree line, there was like the direction and the tempo. And then you could see that there were some experiments that had been run from today to get to that direction, if you're evolving from the present, really. And some of them were failing because if there are X's on them, and some of them were kind of doing okay, they survived and moved on. But there was still a reference to a shared vision in the top right corner. And I was wondering, is that just a difference of opinion that you have with the authors?
It's interesting. There are visions which work. So, for example, if you take Kennedy's, we must have a man on the moon by.
Mm. Yeah?
But he only says that when the science has been worked out. So it's an engineering problem. And I would do something similar now on refreezing the poles. We know the science. It's an engineering problem. It would give the human race another 10 years breathing space. And boy, do we need more options. Yeah, I don't think it works where you don't know that you can solve the problem.
Right.
Then the other problem is vision statements tend to be platitudes. Yeah, they're the same words, the same phrase. Everybody knows how to parrot them. An anthropologist will tell you the minute you write your values down, you just lost them because you're teaching people the language of power. These things need to be implicit, right? If we're looking at strategy, the basic Kinevin approach to strategy is start off by mounting what's called the counterfactual space. Now, this is a reference to constructor theory in physics. Mm. You define what isn't possible, and you do that through constraint. And then you also examine the constraints to say, could we change the constraints to make some things possible which are currently impossible? And that defines your decision space. And then you create constructors which have produced replicable results. So like a machine always produces the same sort of outcome. Well, if I have, for example, entangled trios, which connects people across silos, it always produces similar outcomes, and that's a constructor. So I throw constructors into the space and see what happens. That's Mintzberg's emergence strategy. But emergence is still architected. It's not just wait and see what happens. It's you map the constraints, you build the constraints, you identify the constructors, you test the constructors, you test them in parallel, they're safe to fail. There's a whole science behind managing for emergence. But to be honest, out of all the classics, I love Henry, I've met him a couple of times, yeah? He's the closest to complexity theory of all the classic authors.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping. Because at the moment I'm working on objectives and key results and the idea of quarterly business reviews and all that. It's something that I've been asked to see if it could make it happen and so on. And try to change some of the language from objectives and key results to like desired outcomes and key experiments, and basically try to create lots of uncertainty in the language. But there was a real resistance because, well, why am I making up new words? This is well known. Everybody knows what objectives and key results were. And I was really worried that people would misinterpret John Doerr's work and maybe have so many committed OKRs and very few aspirational ones that they're almost trying to predict the future kind of thing. And I'd love to get your view, Dave, on OKRs and whether you've seen anybody actually doing it properly, or whether you think it's actually something that even goes against complexity in principle.
I mean, they originally really came in Intel, right? Where you look at the origin of them.
Yeah.
Virtually every big management movement over the last 4 or 5 decades has started off in manufacturing. And manufacturing is a closed system. So yeah. Business process re-engineering starts there, Six Sigma starts there. And the trouble is, service, for example, is an open system, not a closed system. So it doesn't work. So the successes of OKR are generally related to closed systems, which are highly ordered, where you can define in advance what you want. And it's a variation of what I said earlier. I would create vector measures for complex, not outputs or outcome. And there is no point in having a single outcome measure where people can claim they did it by better interpretation.
So are you talking about direction and speed then? Is that what you mean by vector?
Yeah, so direction and speed for intensity of effort, that's a vector measure. So where am I? I need to go in this direction. We do that, for example, my more like this, fewer like that. So that is powerful. And you can give an example. So, for example, there's a famous experiment, which you may have heard of, called the Good Samaritan experiment. And I ran this once in the Southern Baptist College. So it's normally done in universities under ethical control. But I spent 3 weeks teaching them hermeneutics, which was fascinating. And then final day, we went through a morning of going through the Good Samaritan experiment, which is a classic parable. And what's interesting, it doesn't tell you what to do. It asks you difficult questions. That's what parables do. They're apophatic. So at the end of that, they all agreed, of course, they wouldn't leave anybody by the wayside. They wouldn't let purity stop them. They'd actually help them out. They'd do what the Good Samaritan did. And then we sent them off on campus on a treasure hunt, of which the prize was a beautiful leather Bible signed by the principal of the college. And we had actors fall by the wayside injured, and we videoed them all consistently ignoring them. Consistently. It's a famous experiment. I did it more brutally. And then we had counselors on hand and we showed them. We had a control group who had a value statement, not a parable. And what was fascinating is all the people who heard the parable admitted they did wrong. The people with the value statement justified what they did against the words of the statement.
Oh.
It was much easier to be retrospective. And yeah, I think there are all sorts of problems in that. But fundamentally, anything based on a predefined outcome is a priori wrong in a complex system. It may be right for an aspect of the complex system, like a boundary condition, which is ordered. So there are ordered aspects in a complex system, but it's always wrong for the system as a whole.
Yeah, so if you had a context where a lot of the work was complicated, maybe it would work.
That's cool. That's fine. In fact, we do it. Good idea.
Yeah, but if it was a situation where the organization was actually in danger of disruption and they almost desperately needed to innovate.
We've done projects which have shown that the main cause of mental breakdown, for example, in fire officers and police firearms officers was health and safety regulations, not the job. Because the health and safety regulations were devised on the center of a normal distribution, whereas their lives have been living in the tail of the Pareto distribution. So in order to do the job properly, you have to break the rules. So that the danger is you get the system definition wrong, everything else goes wrong as a result. And the whole of British hospitals dependent on nurses breaking the rules on a regular basis to provide empathetic care to patients.
Dave, I'd like to finish up today's chat when we're talking about Marion Kiley and Ellie Snowden's chapter. On page 234, there was a lovely image there. The topic was weaving well-being into the fabric of organizations with the Canevin framework. And this rung a bell for me because I recently had to make a lifestyle change myself for health reasons. And I'm not seeing the evidence of it yet. It's going to take a while. But I was just looking at it here in terms of in the clear domain, mindfulness, for example, practicing mindfulness, that was bordering on the complacent area. And then there was physical and mental health promotion, like joining a gym, sleep hygiene sessions, yoga, yogurt, cycling to work scheme, things like that. You follow a recipe, you do it. I mean, whether you'll do it or not is another matter. And then in the complicated space, like focus groups, well-being or stress focus groups, work-related stress, stress risk assessment, peer support programs, employee assessment programs, and measures of stress and mental health and so on. And then over in the complex space, or actually it was on the liminal really, what they're saying here is like change systems such as performance management, career promotion, reward recognition rings a bell with me and a couple of my clients at the moment that enable well-being and remove fear in the organization. Although we'd all love to get rid of fear, wouldn't we? But it's how do we do it? And then using SenseMaker, using a well-being pulse. I love the triangles that you had in SenseMaker. And not using a Likert scale, as you said, everybody knows what the answer should be in the Likert scale. They find it more difficult to figure out where to put the dot in a triangle. It's not naturally in the middle of the triangle. It's kind of magnetism from each of the corners. And then you had on the liminal between complex and chaotic, working with stories, safe-to-fail experiments, anecdote circles, sense-making workshops. Then, of course, the chaos you'd have, which is what we all want to avoid as humans, is medical interventions, like having to call the ambulance or having some kind of burnout. Yeah. So even in normal life, this is something that can be used, right?
Yeah, it is. And a lot of what we're working on, and people have used Canevin to understand their own personal situation. There's articles on that on Google Scholar, if you look. I think that the well-being one is particularly topical because we're about to face, in fact, we are facing a mental health plague, which is as bad as COVID. Now, the formal systems can't handle that. So one of the things we're looking on the well-being pulses is to increase the informal peer-to-peer narrative support. So if you can find more people suffering like you and you can listen to their stories, that helps you manage your situation. And that's one thing we can do with SenseMaker because we've got the narratives. It's also an early warning device. That's the weak signal detection background it came from in counterterrorism to trigger an alert where conditions may be triggering, for example, a sudden crush of mental health cases. Because the earlier you can get that, the better. So those are sort of complex system techniques we worked on and developed. And I think one of the things they rightly bring out is physicality is important in a Zoom-based generation. A lot of mental health is going to come from people getting too used to virtual environments, which are deeply stressful because it's actually quite interesting. It's less stressful to switch off the pictures. Because if you see people, you're expecting other stimulus like smell and all sorts of things by which we make decisions. Mm. Yeah. If you're not getting that, then it's not a problem. So mental health is a big issue. And I think they're completely right to dump wellbeing programs bottom right, because they're just tick box exercises. You run people through a 2-day course and say you've done something about the mental health. Waste of time. Possibly not a waste of time, but it's not going to make any big difference.
Mm. Dave, thank you very much. A really interesting book. Highly recommend people out there read it. It's not a book that you can speed read. I read a lot of books and I can read a lot of books very fast. This is one that you really need to be careful as you read it, because you might miss something. There are some chapters that you can get through quickly, but most of them I've found I had to really be concentrating, but it's really very valuable. And Dave, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Real pleasure.
If you would like your voice message to be featured on a future podcast episode, please leave a voice message at anchor.fm/xagility/message. That's anchor.fm/xagility/message. Thank you.